Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 332 of the podcast. It's Saturday, 29th of July, 2017, as I record this. And can you believe we're coming to the end of the seventh month? It is time to get your annual plans into gear if you haven't already. So today I'm talking with Dean Wesley Smith about the magic bakery of intellectual property rights. So that is coming up. And Dean is one of my mentors, along with his wife and business partner, Christine Catherine Rush. They have so many years of publishing experience between them, and their nonfiction books are always on my list to read and reread. And in fact, I have next to me Chris Rush's book, Goals and Dreams, which is in print on my desk because it reminds me not to be so angst-ridden as I was on last week's show. So it helps me focus. And just reflecting on last week's show, I want to say a huge thank you to all of you for the comments, emails, tweets, Facebook comments that you have left me. Last week's show got the biggest response of any podcast I've ever done. And, you know, far too many comments and emails and tweets and things to read out any this week. I went through them and just there were too many, and everyone was so lovely and supportive and, you know, said that what I was going through is something they were going through too. So thank you so much for letting me know that last week's show resonated with you. And clearly, anxiety, self-doubt, comparisonitis, these are all huge topics for writers. So yeah, feel happy if you go through a similar thing. I think it's something that we all do. And I'm so glad it resonated with many of you. And I will definitely do another similar personal show in the future if I have something significant to share that goes beyond my usual introduction. So yeah. So back to the magic bakery idea and intellectual property rights. I've been thinking about this a lot more because in the last couple of weeks, obviously in New York, but also since I've been back, I've had a number of meetings and coffees and met up with people who have been in traditional publishing for quite a long time and would be considered mid-list authors. Now, it used to be that mid-list authors could make a living with mid-list deals, and but it seems that the traditional publishing industry is shaking out into an ever widening inequality. And at one end of the scale, you have the very big names, those who kind of prop up publishers with their book sales, and then you have the debuts who might get a big deal because publishing will often throw money at a new author to see what sticks. And then there's the 90% of authors in the middle who can't really make a living anymore because advances have dropped and royalties are lower. And, you know, like the rest of us, their books are competing with an ever-growing pool of things to do. You know, we're all competing with Netflix and Amazon Video and all the rest of the things that are possible for us to do with our time. So it's a very interesting time in publishing, and I discussed this with Orna Ross on our latest advanced self-publishing salon, which we do every month, and that is at the selfpublishingadvice.org site, and you can find that there as a podcast. And we were talking about this, and again, all the people I've been talking to in the last few weeks, and what I've said to people usually is revisit the rights that you've actually licensed. Because if, for example, you sold UK Commonwealth, then you could self-publish in the US and the rest of the world. Or if you sold US Canada, you can self-publish in the rest of the world. And even if you have smaller rights left, say Canada, Australia, and other countries, because together they do add up, then you could self-publish outside the big markets and still make, you know, some money. And it's all about multiple streams of income. That is what it keeps coming back to. And it's so interesting for me to talk to people who a few years ago
I thought were the top of the tree, and in fact may well have been the top of the tree a couple of years ago, and then things have changed. So the other things are, you know, if you've sold ebook and print but not audio rights, think about how you could potentially use that. You know, there are a lot of audio deals going around at the moment, and you can also do it yourself through ACX or Findaway Books through Drafter Digital, or, you know, all the other ways. There are many ways to repackage your IP rights. So if you're listening and you are a traditionally published author in the Midlist and you're looking to make more income, then the first thing to do is really look at what rights you've licensed and how you can package up the rest of them. I mean, box sets are still awesome and are something that you can do if you have rights. You know, even if you've written articles for magazines that have gone out of print, maybe you've got the rights back there. There's so many things you can do. So I hope that today's show gives you more ideas. And in publishing this week, there was a very interesting article that I saw on the Financial Times, but it was widely reported, and I'll link to the BBC in the show notes, but you can find this anywhere. It was big news. So this guy, Louis Fonsi, or Louis Fonsi Despacito, has become the most streamed song of all time, just 6 months after it was released, overtaking Justin Bieber and Ed Sheeran's Shape of You. Yes, this guy who you've probably never heard of, Louis Fonsi, and I was reading this article about it and how streaming is democratizing the music market. Just reading from the article on the BBC, streaming has allowed a song with a different beat from a different culture in a different language to become this juggernaut of success and pleasure. The industry has predominantly been English-speaking artists for the last 50 years, but streaming will continue to open up music, and anything and everywhere is up for grabs. So just that quote again, anything and everywhere is up for grabs. And I mean, you know, I go on and on and on about the global market and how exciting it is, but this is what will happen with ebooks as global internet gets faster for people all over the world who access content through mobile devices. We are going to see more phenomenons like this. So if your books are in English and not available everywhere, and I mean everywhere, 190 countries you can publish in through, if you go through Amazon, Kobo and iBooks together, you can reach all these countries. And if you write in other languages, still get your books out there because your time is clearly coming. That this Spanish language song has beaten big names in English. And as 4G internet reaches the rest of the globe, which it will do over the next few years, and with the rise of trackable micropayments that the music industry is getting into, because of course, one of the issues with streaming has been how do the various people involved in the creative production get paid? But the music industry is working this out with the idea of these micropayments. And if we can use trackable micropayments with ebooks and secondhand ebooks, because I do believe that's the way things are going, we are going to see an even bigger revolution for creatives. And this multiple streams of income, micropayments, global sales, mobile sales, this to me is what's exciting. So forget the crash in high street retail, which if you read economic news, you will be seeing everywhere. That is not where we play. And so I am even more excited about global opportunities than I have ever been. And I hope that you are too, and that I can continue to at least be a cheerleader for this. Of course, remember, I'm usually early, so this might take longer than I think, but I still, you know, I'm only 42. It's going to happen before I'm 50. There you go. And then also back on the global expansion theme, Amazon have just announced the Pen to Publish contest with the tagline Recognizing Literary Excellence. And it's open to residents of India, Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom and the United States. So only those five countries publishing on Amazon.in. which is, of course, the Indian Amazon store. So if you publish between 25th of July and 10th of November 2017, and you opt in for KDP Select. And the thing is, if you publish on KDP Select, but you know, right now, you're going to be on Amazon.in, so you don't have to do anything different. And if you are publishing, have a look, your books will be available on Amazon.in. And although, of course, the award says it's about literary excellence, if you check the judging criteria, it does say it's based on commercial viability, book sales, borrows, and customer feedback on Amazon.in. So if you have an audience in India and can get reviews and sales in that period, then, you know, it might be worth it. I will consider it because I would love to be big in India, mainly so I can have more tax deductible trips there more often. I would love to speak at an Indian conference. And yeah, I mean, I'm a real Indiaphile. I'm sure there's a better word for that. But basically, this is very interesting because one, these types of competitions are clearly aimed at getting more authors to publish in these various countries. And secondly, also to help to get authors to drive readership in these countries. I think it's very, very clever from Amazon's perspective. And of course, you know, we all love Amazon, you know, and there are always pros and cons, but they have changed the landscape. And this, to me, is pushing the landscape further. They are deliberately targeting India for growth. We've seen that they've invested a lot of money in growing Amazon.in and into, you know, Amazon Cash in India and trying to get people to buy stuff online in a very physical cash-driven market. So I think this is evidence of global growth and a global push in India. So very interesting. And I will keep an eye on that. Yeah. So, and I would love to hear from you if you are an Indian author or if you're selling decent numbers of books in India. I'd love to know. Obviously, if you are going to publish in India, just a little tip, if you allow Amazon to deliberately determine your price in Indian rupees, it will be far too high and you won't sell any books. When I was in India a couple of years ago, a brand new paperback book in the shops was about 150 rupees. So I've been pricing my ebooks at 99 rupees INR. So just a little tip there, you will find that your print books are way too expensive. Your ebooks are way too expensive. So if you are going to do this competition, remember to go check your prices on Amazon.in. And of course, this competition comes off the back of the Kindle Storyteller competition for the UK, which was announced this week and was won by David Ledbetter, who writes great thrillers, and his book, The Relic Hunters, won. He has 20 books already and has sold over 750,000 ebooks. So he's already a committed indie, putting out, you know, a number of books per year in a good selling genre. And he's doing well, I know, because I've targeted him with some of my Amazon ads. And I've read a number of his books because they're kind of in my arcane niche. And yeah, doing very well. So even though the Kindle Storyteller was, you know, originally many of us thought it would be for new novelists, it was won by an established author. And I think that will probably happen with the Indian Awards as well. I think it's very hard for a brand new author with no audience to get reviews and sales and borrows on their first book. So interesting times for sure. Okay, so my personal update. I'm really happy to be back in my routine. And, you know, after going away, I love traveling. Like, traveling is very important to me as a creative and just as a person. It's just part of me. And but I'm happy to be back in my routine, particularly over getting back to my book. My map book, as I'm calling it. Very challenging coming back after a couple of weeks away. And in a first draft, a couple of weeks away means that you kind of forget what the hell you were doing. And also after the emotional angst of the conference, which you all heard about last week, I was almost dreading getting back into it because I had wound myself up to the point that I thought everything I'd written was completely useless and that it would be terrible. So I spent that first day rereading the sort of 40,000 words I've written already and reverse outlining, kind of writing notes on my characters based on what I'd written and my world so I could re-inhabit them again. And first of all, the writing was not as bad as I remembered, which was a relief. And the story idea is still something I'm really into. But yeah, kudos to fantasy writers, because making up the rules of another world is much harder than using the real world, as I have done with most of my fiction so far, although I've always had a little edge of the supernatural. So in order to get back into the swing of this, and my aim is to finish the first draft by the end of August. And of course, that is, you know, not a polished product at all, but to at least finish that first draft by end of August. So I have booked a room in a local co-working space where I do dictation. And I'm also going to be back at my cafe desk first thing in the morning. And so I really need to get that done in order to go back through. I think this is going to need a lot more editorial work than, you know, if I'd have written another book in an existing series, because with characters, a new world, a new plot ideas, definitely it takes a lot more work to sort out that first book in a series than doing a subsequent book in a series. I'm also working on a new non-fiction book, The Healthy Writer, which I'm co-writing with a medical doctor. Of course, I couldn't do that on my own. That will be out in January 2018, self-help season. And I will be asking you next week to join me and help us by filling in a questionnaire on health issues and what you've done about your health as writers. I think it's a huge issue in our community, especially with working on multiple books and working a lot, very hard. I mean, there's a lot of indies working very hard, a lot of writers working very hard. So, and we do have specific health issues. So if you're on my email list, you'll get an email about that this week. And if you're not on my email list, why not? Go to thecreativepen.com/blueprint if you're not on my list, and you'll get lots of useful stuff and you'll hear from me, which is cool. Well, I hope you think it's cool. Okay, so thanks again for all your emails and tweets and comments on last week's show. I'm not actually going to read out any because I had so many, it's hard to choose everything. So thank you, heartfelt thank you to all of you. I really mean that. It's been an amazing week, and I have replied to every email, I think, and most tweets, and, you know, thank you. Anyway, moving on, today's show is sponsored by my own How to Write a Novel course, which I created while writing End of Days. So you get a behind the scenes look at how the book came together. The course has videos, audios and slides, so you can do it at your own pace. There's also a private Facebook group where you can ask me questions. So is it for you? Well, is it your dream to write a novel, but you just don't know where to start? Have you started writing only to run out of ideas? Are you suffering from self-doubt about whether you're good enough to write a novel? And do you feel overwhelmed by all the information and craft books out there and you just need a fresh approach? So if you've answered yes to any of these questions, then the course might be for you. One course member, Lee Anderson, said, "This course is exactly what I was looking for. I now feel well on the way to writing and completing my first draft. It has been a real breakthrough for me." So you can find out more at thecreativepen.com/write novel. Or you can always email me if you have any questions about whether it's for you, joanna@thecreativepen.com. So this corporate sponsorship, or type of sponsorship, pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, and we have a bit of a bumper crop this week, probably because I almost cried on last week's show. So thanks to Shane Edmonston, Caroline Dudley, Joseph Adam Davis, Lindsay Baroka, T. Thorne Coyle, Jason Hamilton, All Timelines, Tony Hernandez, and thanks also to Sally Stevenson for upping her pledge. So thank you, everybody. Thanks to new patrons. Thanks to all the existing patrons who've been supporting the show, some of you for a couple of years now. So I really appreciate that. And if you would like to support the show on Patreon, you can do that for a coffee a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous. And you will get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I guess August is almost here. So I will be recording in the next couple of weeks and you'll get all the backlist, extra audio, and you can ask me questions and all of that. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview. Today, I'm here with Dean Wesley Smith. Hi, Dean.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. It's great to have you back on the show. Just a little introduction. Dean has published hundreds of novels and short stories, including books in the Star Trek, Men in Black and X-Men worlds, as well as many written under different pen names, plus his own science fiction, fantasy, thriller and other books. He has his own monthly magazine, Smith's Monthly, and writes a daily blog on his writing journey. And there's practically no one better to talk about writing. So thanks for coming back on the show, Dean. Oh.
Thanks for having me back. And it's fun. I always enjoy talking with you.
It is great fun. Now, scarily, you were on the show back in 2010. I can't believe it's been so long when we first met online. And you were writing, at the time, the first iteration of Killing the Sacred Cows of Publishing series. So 2010, think back to then. Now, big question, what has changed for you in the last 7 years in terms of publishing practices and opinions? Because you'd really kind of just gone indie, hadn't you, in 2010?
Yeah, I had basically, if it hadn't been for the indie world firing up, I would be out of publishing. I would be done. I was tired of all the problems with New York. The contracts were starting to go draconian. I wasn't going to be able to sign them. And I had signed a lot of bad contracts over the years with media and other stuff like that, but I wasn't going to be able to sign them anymore and give my own copyright away for forever, the life of the copyright. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I was tired of all of the stuff that was going on, the lack of respect and everything else that was happening. And so I was kind of fading away. I was going to go play professional poker again. I'd already done that once. I'd come back to publishing. I was going to go back and do it again. And here comes the indie revolution. And so the Sacred Cow stuff was me trying to basically warn people about traditional publishing on that start part, you know, about agents and about all the other stuff that you don't need. And then from that point forward, it morphed into the Sacred Cows of indie publishing. And I haven't done one for a while now. Every so often, something will get under my skin and I'll do another Sacred Cow. But, you know, I haven't done one for a while now.
Yes.
It's changed. Everything has changed. Everything has changed.
But in terms of your own writing, because you were doing a lot of these books under other people's IP, weren't you? And then since then, you've kind of created your own stuff.
Well, right towards the end, I was doing a lot of ghostwriting. And I was the kind of ghostwriter that was only hired by New York publishers. I only did one in all of it that I was hired by an actual author to hire me to ghostwrite something. All the rest of it, New York hired me to save somebody, to save one of their big name authors. And so I was tired of that. I'd done a lot of that. I was tired of the media, even though I still am a major fan of Star Trek and Men in Black and all the other stuff, and Spider-Man, and all the other books I did. I was just kind of, you know, after 30 or 40 media, 50 media books, I got kind of tired. Mm. And so I was just ready to move on and do my own books. So I was writing thrillers under a pen name, and they're still out there. They're still selling. But I signed a do not disclose, which is basically that I couldn't tell anybody that those were my books because the publisher flat did not want, you know, them to be hyped as, oh, Dean Wesley Smith writing as, you know, the Star Trek writer, Dean Wesley Smith writing as. And so I think now it would be less of an issue since I've known for my own books now more because I've done 60 or 70 of my own books under Dean Wesley Smith. Mm. It's just at that point in time. So that was sort of towards the end of my traditional career was I was doing these thrillers under a pen name. Mm. I had two series is going and I just got tired of doing that too because I just decided to put everything under my own name.
Which is fantastic.
Smith's Monthly Magazine.
Yeah. So, and then in terms of like you had got sick of the contracts back in 2010, which way has the industry gone? Like as in now in 2017, you know, people much, looking at traditional publishing.
Much, much worse. It is. I mean, I was tired of them back then. And in 2008 and 2010, 7 years later, New York publishers, the big traditional publishers, have gone to rights grabs. They're basically trying to grab intellectual property. And there's accounting reasons for it. There's all kinds of valuation readings for it on spreadsheets. But that's what they've done now. And the newer writers who are going to New York are just letting them. They're just giving it to them. And that just appalls me, but you can't stop them. Everybody makes their own decision and they don't realize they're giving their books away for the rest of their life. And that's a long time, less or less 70 years. So not even their heirs will get any money. And so it's kind of one of those sad things. It's just gotten so much worse, so much worse in the last 7 years. And I see contracts all the time because people send me contracts to look at and give my opinion on. They send Chris contracts all the time to get her opinion.
It's really interesting. So that's really what we're talking about today. You have been doing some blog posts on the Magic Bakery, and you've got a book coming out on the Magic Bakery with those blog posts, and that will be awesome. And so can you just explain the metaphor of the Magic Bakery and how it relates to copyright and intellectual property?
Well, it started off because we teach workshops, as you know. You were here last year, and you're coming as one of our guest instructors this next fall. And I got really, really tired over the years of having writers not understand copyright, because that's what we license. That's how we make all of our money. That's what I've been doing for 40 years now, is licensing copyright and making a living at it. And it's hard for me to understand that writers don't grasp copyright. It seems to be the first thing everybody should go learn, but it's usually the resistance is unbelievably difficult. People just, I'll get to it, and then they never do. And because of that, they make bad decisions, all kinds of bad decisions. One of the aspects is I was trying to struggle with ways of explaining copyright. And so I came up with the magic pie. Just think of a pie, and each piece of anything you slice out of that pie is a license that you're licensing to someone to use part of. And so every time you write a short story or write a novel or write a nonfiction book or whatever, or anything that's copyrightable, it forms a pie. Just think of it as a pie. This is that metaphor, which I extend for an entire book. And you slice that out. So say you want to sell a short story to Asimov. So you take that pie, you cut out, and then you name that right, whatever you and the other person agree to, and that goes away. But it's still in the pie. Nothing's really sold. It's magic. And this pie stays there. And unless you do something like selling it all rights to New York, that magic pie stays. And so then, of course, those of us who have a lot of stuff, I created a bakery. And also that helps explain selling a lot with magic pies. That's the stuff that's kind of fun, is that if you realize, I've done one novel, why aren't I making a lot of money? Well, imagine a customer walking into a bakery and there's one pie sitting on the shelf. They're going to turn around and leave because everything else is empty. And that's exactly what writers are doing. That's why these newer writers are going, I only have one book and it should be selling. And I'm so disappointed. And I'm like, fill your bakery. Have something for your customers to purchase and have ways for them to come in. So that's how this whole magic bakery got about, is because copyright really is magic. You can resell it and resell it and resell it, and it goes on forever.
And keep going. Obviously, the problem is that many people don't know how many ways to slice the pie. So just to kind of get more specific, most people listening will understand ebook, print book, and audiobook, even though, of course, that those can be sliced in many ways themselves.
A bunch of ways.
Yeah. So just give us a bit more of what are some of the highest, the slices that you would most likely to license?
Oh, everything from movie rights are different than television rights. Gaming rights are different than movie rights and television rights. In fact, a guy that was a friend of mine who was a major fantasy writer, he's been long dead now, But he came I met him at a convention. I was just early on when I was just starting off, and he came in and he was all excited. And we sat down, and he was just kind of like on heaven. And I said, what's going on, Bob? And he goes, I just licensed my 37th gaming right. And I'm like, what? He said, yeah, I'm just slicing these. And he just was slicing them. He was down into all the stuff. This was 20 years ago. I can't even imagine how many ways you could slice gaming rights now. But he just kept slicing them and selling off, and licensing off the parts. He always just was a license for this over here. For example, another way to cut it is, say you wanted to have translation into Italian. Well, that's a little teeny slice of the pie. The translation right into Italian, you'd sell to an Italian publisher. They would keep it for 5 years or so, do X number of copies, and then that slice would be right back in the pie magically. You know, that's the kind of stuff you start thinking about it, and it's only limited to your own imagination. Yeah. As to how many slices.
And also, I guess...
You make up the names, you and the person that you're selling it to. You make up the names. There's no real standard dictionary of what these rights are called or anything else. I got that question a lot, is what are the rights called? Well, whatever you want to call it.
as long as the definition is nailed down. So we saw a contract from a friend the other day, and the contract said book rights. And I was like, what is book rights? I mean, yeah. Come on.
Yeah, no, you need to be a little more specific than that. Yeah, but see, that's where you can get into trouble, is by being too general on these things. And so What is book rights? Is that something that some form, like we didn't know ebooks. Well, we sort of knew ebooks were coming back in 1990, but, you know, we didn't know it was going to be what it turned out to be. And, and so that's where a lot of these contracts, these older writers got into trouble. They sold book rights, and ebooks were then defined as books, and, and they lost their e-rights, you know.
Yes.
It's just you got to be specific as you can be. You have to define it. You and the person on the other side of the contract for the license needs to be as specific as you can. Cut that pie as thin as you can slice it.
Yeah. So one of the things that you say is that authors don't need an agent. And One of the things that authors believe they need an agent for are things like contracts and understanding some of these terms. So explain why you don't think people need an agent, or what are the problems with that?
Oh, the problems of agents are legion. I mean, you know, they're the horror stories out there. And I had a whole bunch of them. I had an agent for 17 years, one of the top agents, you know, and that helped start Writer's House, actually. I mean, I was there for 17 years, and I have nothing bad to say. Her name was Marilee Heifetz. She's still in the business. She's a tremendous agent. The problem is that she was with Writer's House. And the other side of the coin is she got in the way. You know, Chris and I have continuous stuff going on with movie rights and television rights and a couple gaming rights, not so much at the moment because our stuff doesn't really translate gaming too well, but, we have a lot of that's going on. And the truth of the matter is that we literally have, we didn't get any of that when we had an agent. Because the agent was always blocking it. And so we deal with all the negotiation. We know what we want. Writers can learn. It's not rocket science. it's not rocket science. It's something that's learnable. It seems fearful. And at a certain point, you get an IP attorney involved. And, you know, but not early on. You don't, you know, you do everything by email. So you have a paper trail. You don't ever talk to anybody on the phone. You do everything by email. And you follow that basic rule and you have a paper trail, and that's all you need. And then you'll make mistakes, but they won't be anywhere near as bad as some agent giving everything away. Those stories are horrible. And then having to pay them 15 cents because they gave all your work away, you know, or you had to wait for them for 6 months, or you had to, and the stories just go on and on. You just don't, they get in the way. I am not kidding. They get in the way. And then we won't even count the fact that they also steal your money. Let's don't even go there. Marilee didn't. Not saying that Marilee did, but more. The stories are probably more than 100 on just my close friends now of embezzlement. One of the best places they embezzle, of course, is foreign rights, because you don't know you've sold foreign rights. They'll often will sign contracts. Chris had one agent that signed contracts for her, and they weren't supposed to. They just signed her name, and you know, total fraud. And again, you got to realize agents are not licensed. They're called agents, but they don't have any agent fiduciary duties. They can keep your money. You put on your New York traditional publishing contract right there that all money is sent to the agent. It is never said that it has to be sent to you. Mm. It's in that contract. The publisher fulfills, sends the money to the agent.
Do you think it's about the kind of the myths of what could possibly happen, like the lottery win of some authors, that there's still this need for the ecosystem?
It's ego. it's all ego early on in your career. It's ego, you know, and, you know, it seems like that's one of the myths of, oh, I'm now a successful writer. I've got an agent, you know. No, agents hand out cards like they're candy to children. You know, you just go to a convention, you get 10 agents' cards, and they're worthless. They're just totally worthless, but you could have an agent. It just doesn't do anything for you as a writer. The problem with writers, all of us as a class, and I was probably, I'm 100% certain I was no exception to this rule, is that we have insecurity issues. And especially early on, you know, we don't believe in our own writing. We don't believe in our own skills. And yet we should. We're artists. And so we let people in that should never be in. We let people critique our work that should never critique our work. We let agents tell us how to rewrite. And an agent's never sold a book in their life. If agents could write, they would be writing because that's where the big money's at. But we listen to these people. They listen to, you know, peer groups that don't know how to write, tell us how to write. We're all insecure, and that need to go to New York and give them all of our rights and have an agent, it makes for good story with the family. You know, the family, you know, your family goes, hey, I'm successful now. Hey, oh, so-and-so is successful. Pat him on the head. How come he's still working down at Safeway? You know?
And because I think this, I think the comparisonitis is also an issue. You know, like I had some friends who were at the HarperCollins summer party, and everyone posts their pictures, and then you're like going, why aren't I at that party? You know, that kind of thing. You know, this how do you deal with this comparisonitis, or have you ever suffered from it? You seem so confident.
Oh, sure. I think we all do. I think we all do. When I was, realize that before the indie world, there was no other choice. You had to go to New York. It was a different world when I came in. And I don't try to teach how I came in because it would be wrong right now. I mean, I'm an old guy. You don't come in like I did back in the 80s. And I sold my first novel in 1987. I sold my first short story in 1974. So, I mean, that's another planet back there. But the reality is that, sure, I had those issues. I mean, you know, for the longest time, the very first convention I went to, I happened to run into a wonderful writer by the name of Pat Murphy, and I had turned a story, you know, my very first science fiction convention, I turned a story into the writer's workshop. And she was the young writer. She'd only published two or three things in Asimov, so she wasn't very far ahead of me. But she was the young writer who'd been stupid enough to volunteer for this writer's workshop. And she said, oh, you're so-and-so, I love your story. I'm like, nobody's ever read that story. And, you know, but she had, because she was doing the writer's workshop. And so she ended up taking me around to all the parties behind the scenes. And the friends that I went to the convention who were other beginning writers, all they saw me is I met Pat Murphy and vanished. And they didn't see me until the third day. And it wasn't I was doing anything. I was just in all the pro parties. And these guys didn't even know where the pro parties were. And at that point, I started realizing, oh, there's this other side. And then the following time I got my friends in, and then we went in, and once you're in the door, you're in the door. And sure, you know, for the longest time, it was an honor to go to the Bantam party.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And then one year down in Amarillo, Texas, or somewhere down there, they put us all on buses for the Bantam party at Worldcon and bussed us an hour into the middle of nowhere to go to this thing. I said, that's the last time going to a Bantam party.
I'm pretty sure the parties were better back in the 80s. I think, you know, everyone's got expense things now.
they were pretty outrageous back then.
Pretty wild. But yeah, so yeah. It's interesting. So I think but what I was thinking as I looked at the party shots was, you've got to think about the value, and the money they're paying for that party with is the money from the authors, right? So, but what's interesting is you say in the book and the blog post that many writers still prefer the idea of getting a sort of advance, so a bigger figure as an advance, without thinking how much they could be getting per month. So the maths is kind of all screwed up in that some people would like a couple of grand now rather than say $100 a month for the life of copyright. So, you know, how should people be thinking about that type of maths?
It's unbelievably difficult for writers to do math. I don't know. I've never met a writer that was that good at math. Other than there's a few, Matt Buckman, of course, M.O. Buckman, because he was a project manager before he became a full-time writer. He's really good at this structure, and he can look at something and say, well, I could sell this for $5,000 over here, or I could do it myself over here for this much time, this much cost, and make this much money over the next 10 years. And even if it's just a trickle, trickles really add up. They really, really add up. And that's you just have to be good at the math, at saying, no, I'm not going to give away my copyright for pride and a couple $1,000s or $10,000, which is spread out over 3 years. And, you know, for where I can do is over here by myself and have control. Because, you know, they're going to put bad covers. They're going to give you bad copy edits because you're a beginning writer. And, you know, that's just a horrid thing to do. You know, I've fought so many copy editors over the year, but now that I'm in indie, I have control of my own copy editors. They copy edit exactly the way I want them to do, exactly the level I want them. And if they don't, I find another one. I love the control. That's the aspect of it. Just love this control aspect of this new world where writers are in control. When I came in, there was no control. We had to go begging. We were like people with little cups going begging for every little morsel we could get. Don't do that anymore. None of that. I'm in control. If I'm not in control, I don't do it.
Well, that's interesting because you also don't like KDP Select or exclusivity in general. Is that a control issue or what are your issues with KDP Select?
trying to trap me here into something larger. Okay. Here's my thinking on that I won't insult anybody, put it that way, which I'm known for doing at times, as you know. Let me put it this way. I want to sell to the whole planet, literally to the whole planet. I don't know if there's somebody sitting somewhere on the planet that picks up a Kobo edition, reads it, and writes me for a movie option. I don't know. I want to have that option. Okay. If I put it into Kindle Select, I have limited my entire audience down to a very small group. Not even all Kindle readers, not even all Amazon buyers go anywhere near Kindle Select because it's sort of known as a big garbage bin. And so, you know, I don't want to go there. I don't want my stuff associated in that garbage bin. I want everybody in the world to be able to read. So if one of my books, hopefully at some point, gets a real word of mouth going and they say, oh, you got to read that Dean Wesley Smith. I want them to be able to find it. And if you're in Kindle Select and they're not on Kindle Select and they're not doing that, which, you know, there's a lot of people that hate Amazon, they can't find your book. And so suddenly they're mad. And who are they mad at? You, the author, because they can't find your book. And we used to deal with this all the time in traditional publishing. Someone in Great Britain would say, I can't find your book. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry. I only sold North American rights. Mm. You know, so it doesn't get over there. And it's just like, now it's there. Now it's everywhere in the world. Mm. And it's easy for us to do. We can have our books anywhere on the planet with D2D, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, and Amazon. You know, between those, we're in almost everything we can find. And library services and stuff like that. You don't get any of that on Kindle Select.
Mm. No,
it's put it this way, it's bad business. And it's very short-term thinking. You can really hurt yourself. Not counting the fact that Amazon can, at any given moment, change the rules on you. And they have 3 or 4 times over the last few years. I try not to giggle publicly when that happens.
No, they have indeed. And it's interesting. So coming back, you said you want to sell to the whole planet, which I do as well. I'm really into like global stuff. And I think one of the problems many authors have is an issue with ambition, like being able to say something like that out loud. Or, you know, I know, you know, you like money. I like money. We like, you know, thinking about business and that type of thing. And many authors still have that issue between the business and the art. So how do you reconcile that? You know, how do you talk about that to people?
I think it's a two hat. I consider it two hats. When I'm actually sitting down writing, which I'm doing a lot of this month, actually, you know, I literally do the best I can. I write what I want to write, not to some market, not to anybody's idea of what I should write or anything else. I just sit down and write what I'm passionate about, you know, and that's it. Nothing more. And I do the best job I can do. And I'm constantly learning because I'm doing so much teaching and workshops and other stuff that I'm constantly learning. And then I'm applying that in this practice that I'm writing. I'm just having a blast. And so I make my writing fun. I do the best I can. And then I release it. When I release it, the artist hat comes off and the business hat comes on. And I go, okay, now, what kind of systems do I need to set up that I can sell that all over the world and get as many cash streams from that one piece of few hours of writing that I did? How many cash streams can I get off of that? And that's how I look at it as a business person. I am the CFO of the company that Chris and I started. We have 9 employees, including a publisher. And Chris and I don't even run the company anymore. You know, Allison Longuera runs the company. You know, every time I'm still the CFO and I go, okay, how can I monetize that? The artist is gone. The artist did its work and it's working on the next story. Mm. I'm having fun as an artist on the next story. On the business, I have the other hat on and I try to monetize it. And I want it around the world, making as much money for me everywhere on the planet as I can. So that's how I do it, is it's just 2 hats. Take off one hat, put on the other. And they never cross. I never take the business hat into the writing. I never write to a market or, you know, what all indie writers now are doing, a lot of that sort of stuff. And then, you know, oh, you got to write a series. Oh, you got to write fantasy. Oh, you got to write whatever's the hot new thing. No, just write what you love. Eventually it works out.
It'll come around again.
I'm proof of that.
You know? And then you and Chris actually have different physical spaces, don't you, in where you do writing and business?
Yes, this is where I'm standing right now because I couldn't get my Skype going. This is Chris's internet office. She has a reading chair back over here. And all of this is some of our digest collection. We have one digest of every science fiction, mystery and horror digest up to about the year 2000. And this, all 4 of these walls are covered with digests, as you can see some of them over here. And she has a standing computer here, which I don't stand for anything. And then she has another over here, and this is all of her business office here, and it is one floor above her writing office is down over that way and clear down through a library and back in another corner of the building. My writing and my internet are in the same room. But they're 2 different businesses. They face 2 different things. On one wall I have creative stuff, and on the other wall I have business stuff. So I'm facing business when I'm at my internet computer, and I'm facing creative stuff when I'm at my writing computer. And I have 2 chairs, 2 different setups, 2 different everything. So when I stand up from one and go to the other, the hats change.
I actually think that's really helpful.
And I have 2 spaces.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. And I don't write fiction where I'm standing now. I do all my business stuff here. And then I go to various other places when I'm writing fiction. Because I think, and you pointed this out years ago about the 2 different computers. And that second computer doesn't need to be like the fanciest Mac, does it? It can just be like basic. Anything.
Yeah, it's a mindset. When you're sitting down at your writing computer, you don't do anything else on it. You have no internet, no games, no nothing. When you sit down, what happens is your creative voice is trained. Oh, I'm here to write. And it just clicks on. And so all of that startup and all that problem, it just literally by having a second computer, maybe in a different chair, changes everything. Just changes it. It really makes that mindset work for you.
Yeah, that creative voice. So let's just talk about that, because obviously you're an incredibly prolific writer, well known as, you know, incredibly prolific. But yet you've said that you don't write massive numbers of words per hour. So what is your secret, Dean? Everyone can find it in your many books, but tell us your secret.
The secret is I sit down more than other people. And I don't do it anywhere near. I'm like every other writer. I feel like I don't write enough. Although when I say that, my friends get a little bit panicked, and Allison gets really worried, because I mean, I turned in 7 books in the last 2 weeks. And you know, I'm writing right now, I'm writing 4 novels in this month, which will turn into 4 novels plus 4 Smith's Monthlies plus a nonfiction book about writing the 4 novels in the month. And so, I mean, that's going to be 9 more books right there, 9 more major projects, not counting all the short stories that are in Smith's Monthly. I did 30 of those in April.
Did one a day, right?
I did one a day for April, and I did it a year ago, July. I did one a day in July too. When you're filling your own magazine every month, I do 4 short stories and 1 novel every month for my own magazine, plus a nonfiction or something else. So it's 70,000. It's the same size as Asimov's every month. The old Asimov's, not the new double issues. But I'm doing that every month. So I am prolific, and the only difference is I write about 1,000 words an hour. I take breaks because I have eye issues. And so basically I just spend more hours.
Yeah, and I think that's the point. So you will sit down for, say, 4 hours, or not, you won't sit down for the entire 4 hours, but you will allocate, say, 4 hours to writing, whereas many people might allocate half an hour or 1 hour.
And a lot of people believe in the myths that you can't write a lot, and, oh, it'll burn out your brain, and, oh, I get so tired when I'm writing. I'm like, why are you getting tired when you're writing? That's just, you're just sitting making stuff up. That's fun. You know, it's energizing. Yeah, sure. I mean, after I write 6,000 or 7,000 words in 6 hours or so, you know, yeah, I get tired. But it's a good tired, and it's a fun tired, and I'm still thinking about the story and everything else. It's just, it's myth. It's mindset myth. You know, the myth of, I'm an artist, so I can only work 30 minutes a day. Hooey. You know, I don't have time. Well, that means you probably never will be a writer if you don't find the time. But 15-minute segments is what I look at it. If I got 15 minutes, I can sit down. 15 minutes will give me 300-400 words. You know, that's all it takes.
Mm. And so, I think the other thing, like, I've done a number of your courses, which are awesome, and one of them is on productivity. And you talk about getting out of your own way. And I think that is a huge issue for people. So any tips on getting out of your own way so you let creative voice come through?
Oh boy, it's the myths that are the biggest problem there. We all have these belief systems, and the problem with the belief systems is that it brings up the critical voice, and then it brings up fear. Mm. And when we're fearful, instead of it's like, if you're really fearful of a crash on a roller coaster, you're not going to get on the roller coaster. But you get on the roller coaster because you want to experience the exhilaration and the excitement and the twists and the turns and the ups and downs and the kind of the adrenaline. Well, that to me is what writing is that I'm not fearful of the writing. Nothing can go wrong. Absolutely nothing can happen. Nobody can come and shoot me, or I can't fall out of the top of a roller coaster or anything else. I mean, the worst that could happen maybe is I fall out of my chair, but you know, that's about it. And you know, so there isn't a lot of really important consequences to writing. And so I just, actually the biggest failure is not writing. That scares me to death. And if more writers took that opinion and said, well, I'm more scared of not writing than I am of writing, they would find their way to the chair more often and get more writing done.
Mm.
That's the thing, is you just got to be more afraid, because total failure in writing is not writing. So that's total failure. There is no failure if you're actually producing words. Nothing can hurt you. You know, people may not like your story. Well, who cares?
You know, yeah, okay, exactly. Well.
Yeah.
I think people feel like worry that they are wasting time if they're writing something that ends up not being very good. So these kind of definitions.
Oh, yeah, you hear that all the time. I hear it continuously. It's just, you know, the wasting time is, no writing is ever wasted. Mm. Because it's practice. That I know I just used a swear word. I apologize for the word practice, because practice is not something you would ever use around writers, because all of their words are golden and they have to be perfect. That's how writers think. That's how that myth is built up, as you sit down and you write, and you write the perfect story from word one to the end. No, it's just practice. Just practice. I never stop practicing, and I never have. I've written getting close to 200 novels now, and you know, and more. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of short stories that I can think about. And the reality is every one of them been practice. I am practicing all the time. And that's, you know, sometimes I get a little tidbit out of one of the workshops and I go, wow, that would be fun. And I'll practice that for the entire book that I'm working on. The entire book. And just that one little tidbit. So to me, it's just practice. There's never a wasted word. And I throw a lot of words away. I write into the dark, you know, so I'll go down side roads and go, oh yeah, well, better back up over here. You know, I do that all the time. It's just part of the process. It's just part of the process, you know.
Yeah. And I love how much you always seem to be having fun. And, you know, that's why I really enjoy your courses. So I did want you to talk a bit about your courses, because there are a lot of courses out there right now. But you have some really interesting ones at different levels. So I did your depth course on writing. And the book I wrote off the back of that is now award nominated, which is very exciting. So
congratulations.
Thank you. I hopefully I'll win it like next week. But it was interesting that it came off the back of doing that workshop. But you also have advanced, like I did your advanced tax workshop the other day. And of course, people listening, you don't.
It was a lecture.
Yeah. And these are online courses and some have homework, some don't. But I'm about to do your one on movie deals and stuff like that. So you have things for all kinds of people, don't you? So maybe just tell us a bit more about the courses and how people can find those and what types of things you have.
Well, thanks to you, we're over on Teachable now for all of the lectures, and I've been moving them like crazy since last October, the minute you said, "Dean, go there." And I'm like, "Oh, thank you." And so, you know, I want to thank you publicly for that. And the lectures and some of the classic workshops, which don't require homework, are now there. And I hope over this next month or so to have all of what we call classic, which means they were homework based workshops like the productivity workshop, but now they're just classic workshops and they're on Teachable. If you've ever taken it, you can keep going back to it anytime you need it. That's the nice thing about Teachable. It's always on your dashboard on Teachable. The other workshops we do are the where I actually give feedback on homework. And we're doing 12 a month now on those. And one of them that runs every month is the depth in writing workshop. That's how to get readers down into your story so that they can't leave, down into the depth of your story. Mm-hmm. That makes a tremendous difference because the depth has to be all the way through. It has to be through all of your chapters and all of your everything. And so once you learn those techniques, you automatically start using it through the whole book. And it won't let readers out of books. That's basically, it makes books non-put-downable. Then you combine that with like a cliffhangers and all the other stuff we do. We now have three depth workshops. We have depth, advanced depth, and what we're starting here in July is research. Advanced depth number three, research. How to get all that research in through a character in a way that the readers will be interested versus what beginning writers call info dumps, that's a beginning writer, English writer, English teacher term. You know, there's ways to do research and do it correctly through the character. And that's why we called it depth three. That's when you really get the stuff and how much to research, when to stop researching, when to even research, you know, that sort of stuff.
And then you're doing more of the advanced business stuff as well, aren't you, for those who might be a bit further along in terms of business?
Yeah, we have about 20 lectures. And then we started off and then we did we're doing six what we call advanced business lectures. And the taxes, and then I just finished estates for writers. That's one that nobody will take.
I'm going to take it.
Because it's just, you know, that's one of those things of, yeah, I got to get to that. And they never do. But we're doing that. We did corporations and we'll do six of them by the time it's done. I can't remember all six of their titles. But this will be the fourth one we have up, and then we have two more to put up. The estates will be the fourth one, and then there's two more. One of them was movies. Yeah. Movie negotiation.
Yeah.
How to do it correctly.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting is they are, it's about awareness. And that's what I love about what you and Chris do is there's so much smoke and mirrors from the traditional industry. And yet what you're doing is kind of pulling back the curtain and going, hey, you know, it's not that complicated. Here are the things.
Yeah. It's not, we try to break it down into simple all the way through. And if you follow these techniques, you'll do it your own way. You know, and every writer is different, but we basically started to say, you know, no, it's simple. Some of the stuff in some of these workshops, like, you know, like character voice workshop, trying to understand where you can see your own voice and where you can see your character's voice. That gets a little more complex at times, because all of us can't see our own and hear our own voices. But we try to show you how to hear your own voice in that workshop. But it's that kind of stuff. We're very proud of it. We didn't ever intend to do this. This was an accident, and we don't make any money off it. Chris and I make no money off of it. It all goes to WMG. We do it for free, the teaching, because the minute I start getting bored, that's the truth. I mean, we'll move everything to Teachable and then I won't deal with it anymore. But that's why you see some of these older workshops now on Teachable, what we call classics, because I would teach it for two or three times and realize I didn't learn any new thing out of it. Mm-hmm. I'd done the same thing for two or three times. I went, oh, nope, that workshop's gone. you know, because it's me. I'm being very selfish here. I'm glad people are getting a lot out of it, but I'm just doing it for me. And, you know, I'm 67 years old here, and I don't know how much longer I'm going to be doing this stuff. I'm going to go do something else for a while.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And so where can people find you and all that you do online?
Oh, you can find, well, first off, those workshops, you can find either on my site or at WMGPublishingWorkshops.com. And it's WMG, which was Molly Galahad and one of our other cats, workshops.com. Molly Galahad, you know, WMGPublishingWorkshops.com. My stuff is DeanWesleySmith.com. Wesley is W-E-S-L-E-Y Smith.com. DeanWesleySmith.com. Or if you have a question about anything, just email me. You know, my address is dean@deanwesleysmith.com. and that's perfectly fine. I don't mind answering writing questions. You know, a word of warning, I'm blunt.
That's what we love about you, Dean. It's tough love.
What are you thinking? You know, that kind of, I'll say that once in a while. I'll write back to somebody, what are you thinking? Think this through. Usually only to friends. I don't do that to people I don't know. Or I try to.
Well, look, it's been really great to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
So I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Dean Wesley Smith and that you will be building your own magic bakery of intellectual property rights going forward. And I hope this interview has really empowered you with some more ideas. And I think control of your intellectual property is a very empowering concept. So next week, I'm talking about mobile, multimedia and an audience of voracious readers on Wattpad with Ashley Gardiner. And this is fascinating stuff. And a look at readership across various demographics. The rumours of younger people not reading is not true. They are just on mobile. So very exciting about that. So listen in next week. Happy writing in the meantime. And I will see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.